Welcome to the Reaction Podcast. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. I'm joined by my colleagues Maggie Pagano and Alistair Benn. There's a lot to talk about this week. We'll come on to the war in Ukraine and everything that flows from that a little bit later. But first, I think we should probably talk about UK politics, UK economy, because it was the week of the Chancellor's spring statement. I think it's fair to say, Maggie Pagano, that it did not go well.
It certainly didn't. I think he confused a lot of people. He was trying desperately to prove that he's a low tax chancellor. So he promised in the future an income tax cut, but at the same time did not get rid of the national insurance hike, which so many have been trying to persuade him to do. But he did put up the threshold. But what he hasn't done, the great big elephant in the room, if you like, is help people with energy bills and fuel duty and so forth. Well, he cut fuel duty, but as we've already seen on the forecourts, well, certainly anecdotally, is what the retailers have done anticipating a fuel cut is they put up prices again to sort of 181p in some places, and then they cut it. So it brought it back down to the price it was before the budget. Now, I've come to think that budgets are not the most effective ways of running a country's economy, actually.
Same here.
Really do. And I'd like to know, and we should look into what the French and the Germans do, but they can't have this nonsense every year, you know, fiddling like this. But Ian, at the heart of some of these issues is the relationship between Boris and Rishi, which you wrote about so eloquently in the Times this week.
Very kind.
What's really going on there?
Yes, I mean, I think there's a national, it's a mess, policy making, and I think that is a function in part of what's really a dysfunctional relationship between Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson. Now, look, chancellors are often don't get along brilliantly with prime ministers, and a bit of creative tension is very often a good thing, I would say. You know, if you look at Margaret Thatcher and Nigel Lawson, I mean, before they spectacularly fell out, but they were, as well as being close colleagues, engaged in the same mission. They were also intellectual rivals. So there was creative tension, or there was creative tension between Brown and Blair at their very best. And early on, it produced something in political terms that was rather extraordinary and productive for Labour. But what you have here is just this suspicion that, and it's Treasury is always suspicious of number 10, because number 10 wants to do something else. It wants to always wants to spend money, wants to please people, is focused on the next election by necessity. The Treasury sees itself as this repository of longer term, deeper wisdom, and is worried when it has a prime minister who wants to spend too much. In Boris, you have a prime minister who wants to spend on everything, who never really sees a problem, just more borrowing, more projects, never sees an idea for spending that he doesn't like. So they're naturally cautious, which then means, I think, that they overreact. So when you chart this national insurance contributions debacle, which the Chancellor had to unwind a bit this week, well, what does that stem from? That stems from last year, the Prime Minister saying, I'm going to solve the social care crisis in the UK, which I'm pledged to do, and also the NHS needs more money, so let's give them more money and call it a plan. To which the Chancellor and the Treasury said, being suspicious of the Prime Minister, look, if you want to do that, that costs £12 billion, or actually costs a bit more than that, You need to pay for that with a national insurance increase. So hence the rise announced in the autumn. So that's a product of that suspicion. Does that make sense that they felt they had to sort of box him in? The result then is, of course, that hypothecated increase was enormously unpopular, not just with Tory MPs, but when you tested it with voters, not particularly popular either. The Chancellor's then had to go in this spring statement back to give back 70% of it, or ensure that 70% of those hit by in work and hit by the national insurance rise don't then pay it in the end. So what's the point? So rather than tax simplification and a clear line, the relationship between the pair of them produces I think what you called earlier, buggers muddle,
Muddle.
Maggie. It's a real, a real mess. And I don't, I think at a time when the country needs real clarity, almost war era style clarity of communication and thinking about the economy, and we'll come on to what's wrong with the economy, it instead has this rather dysfunctional setup. But Maggie, you raised a point to me this morning in our ahead of our reaction team meeting, where we were kicking a lot of this around about the economic model. And you're right, actually. You stand back from all of the internecine politics and the small stuff which have backfired Sunak this week. We are heading for being, well, as you described it, a high tax, low growth, high inflation, at least temporarily, economy with structural problems stretching out into the next decade. I mean, I don't want to be too gloomy about it, but it looks like we've just had one sort of lost decade. Maybe we're about to have another.
Yeah, that's my fear. And at the same time, surrounding all that is, if you like, the apparatus of a very big state. And what worries me most is, we are quite an entrepreneurial nation, is that what will happen if you're taxing people driving into London, if you're telling people they can't drive, into their main capital city, if you're telling people that their tax is going to go up on every level, they're going to have to buy heat pumps, all of this stuff, is that people will simply start hiding their money and we'll get the growth again of the purple economy. And I've heard instances already of building firms swapping services with architects. The bartering will go on. Builders will ask more for cash. So what will happen actually, the fear is that the tax base will actually start shrinking, will do the reverse of what they hope. And you just knock people's confidence. That's my great fear.
And the political context, Alistair, is looking ahead to this autumn and winter. So you're going to have a high inflation summer. It's going to be really interesting when you get to the autumn. If you've got inflation that's maybe close to 10%, maybe even above it with a further shock, public sector pay is going to be a real issue. I think you're going to see marches and demonstrations on fuel poverty, probably public sector strikes kicking in as well, and a lot of voters, tens of millions of voters, feeling really squeezed and feeling substantially poorer than now or six months ago. The conditions are there, aren't they, for real political turmoil.
Yeah, of course. And the I wonder whether there's a another factor, which is a sort of cultural factor. It's the last time we, saw real that kind of stagnation, and these kind of combinations of rising prices and stagnation of incomes and industrial problems was the 70s. But I wonder, plus energy problems, oil shock, the lights going out, just adjusting. And I wonder whether we are probably following a period of sort of almost, astonishing general affluence, but with still massive inequalities. We are psychologically not really prepared for what that will look like. And, but maybe in the 70s it was, you're coming out of after the war, you had a generation who'd gone through austerity, Britain in the 50s, which was, hardly pleasant. And then maybe it was more resilience built in. There was a kind of class system which protected people's sense of dignity, even if it gave, it created its own problems. There was, all kinds of stability factors. And even then, the 70s was, you look at the culture in general at the time, it was a very dark and scary period in British political history and a time of real sort of fear. And I wonder whether if we're going into that, we are sort of psychologically not in a worse state potentially. Does
I have
is
to say,
that is that a fair thing to say?
that is fair. I mean, having I have to say, I love the 70s, but then I was 6 or 7 years old, and always usually an exciting time. And so even in those moments of real it felt with hindsight, it felt, looking back, when you read people's memoirs, the memoirs of people like Bernard Donohue, who worked for Jim Callaghan, it looks like a country that is disintegrating, falling apart. There's a great bit in Bernard's memoirs where the Prime Minister in, I think, 77, 78, takes delivery of a new car, of course, British built, and it's been delayed. I think it's a new Rover or something, and he's as he attempts to first use the whiz-bang new electric window in the chauffeur-driven car, and I think he's driving down the Mall, the window actually just the glass just falls out, and it's this beautiful, it's a describable, fantastic memoir. I always recommend it. It's one of the best books on the 70s, and it's just a beautiful little metaphor for a country that seems to be falling apart. Of course, it then gets this injection of dynamism. Some people like it, some people think it's the savior of the country, others think that something was lost in the abandonment of collectivism when Thatcher arrives. I mean, it looks to me as though the country really was sinking into the sea, and she brings this new dynamism. There's a lot of turmoil and a lot of very difficult decisions, but then a different kind of country, a different kind of economy comes out of it. I can't, at the moment, I can't see, Maggie, where that comes from in contemporary Britain. We're writing our leader, aren't we, this weekend on this subject, because it doesn't come from Boris, other than
No.
a boosterish sense of everything's going to be fine because everything's going to be fine. I don't see how that, and he's also not a details person in the way that a Thatcher was or a Brown was. So I don't see salvation and regeneration coming through that route in the next 7 or 8 years. And then it's not Starmer's thing either. He's not a he, in terms of the political economy, that's not really his thing either. So is there some, sorry, I'm sounding very bleak here, but where will it come from? Will it have to come from inside the Tory party or some new iteration of something new Labourish?
Well, we can only hope that some sort of dynamism remains within the private sector. The an old-fashioned animal spirits will struggle and will succeed, but the red tape that's been wrapped around them is very tough to fight. I think probably we need political reform, don't we? Because these two great big red and blue blocks are looking very paralyzed, actually. There's no sort of animation. And even if there were on the conservative benches, it's sort of been squashed. And people are fearful. A couple of months ago, people thought that Rishi might have it, or Liz Truss, or someone like that. But it doesn't feel that it's a real, you don't sort of get a sense of a new spirit of political philosophy bubbling away, do you? I think people are exhausted as well. Pandemic, now the war, new Cold War. Another factor making it like the 70s. So I don't know
That's
where it
true,
lies.
actually. If you run it through from, well, so you run it back from 9/11 Iraq, all of that crisis, financial crisis. I mean, this is just history happening. I mean, stuff happens in every decade. But then into the referendums, Scotland, and then the EU referendum, turmoil of Brexit. A feature of just throughout that period, post financial crisis, is of anemic growth or low growth, and just Britain struggling to get back to something like its old trend rate of growth, of which I think used to be, before the financial crisis. I'm sure one of our listeners will correct me, but I think was 2.2% in the preceding decades. And you sometimes had recessions and punctuated by financial emergencies, but just broadly, Britain had relatively healthy growth. And it doesn't seem on the numbers at the moment how that we're going to get back to that anytime soon. What worries me about the way that the Tories are approaching it, and I spoke to an MP this week who put it very well, is that if you look at the coalition of voters, and of course winning in politics is, of course, a political party wants to win and has to win, but this iteration of the Tory party is particularly focused on opinion polling on a daily basis, and Boris's team's number one priority is to reconnect with those Brexity voters who he's lost through Partygate and just the erosion of trust in the last year or so, to reconnect with them. Now, actually, if you look at that coalition of voters, and a lot of them are older, actually, unless they're very poor and in the benefit system, if you're taking the sort of general mass of older voters, it doesn't really matter to them whether there is a. I know it matters to individual listeners. Sorry, if you're a pensioner, of course you want the economy to grow and you want your grandchildren to have a more prosperous country. That's not what I'm saying, but it's not your number one priority, making the economy more dynamic. And you're in the pension system, and if you have a pension, then that's your primary concern. And you have a government which seems pretty much determined to look after your interests in terms of the triple lock and piling more and more pressure on younger voters, on students and people recently in education and in the student loan system, and then the pressure on property and inability to get on the housing ladder. So the Tory instinct is to prioritise that plus the very affluent, who actually, if they're asset rich, are going to do absolutely fine, even in the kind of high inflation, higher rates environment. They'll be okay, and they've got enough of a buffer to still carry on being affluent or super affluent. So the Tory Party is not really incentivized to rethink. I suppose the only voters it then might worry about losing in parts of the South, for example, are, well, it's across the country, but aspirational lower middle class voters who do want to get ahead in a Thatcherite spirit. And if you alienate those people, then where do they go? I mean, they can't go to the Liberal Democrats, who just will want it, probably want even higher taxes. Labour Party is sort of getting its act together in terms of a bit of personnel, but as and posing as the friend of business, but I don't see it coming from there either. So I'm talking myself into complete misery and decline here. But, and as you said, Maggie, there's so many good, interesting, positive, entrepreneurial things happening in the UK. I was in Cambridge a couple of weeks ago. You see what's happening there in this. It's the science capital of sort of bioscience and increasingly tech capital of Europe that's emerging as this city grows, and there's so much entrepreneurialism and ideas and money there. There's a lot of positive stuff happening in the country, but it doesn't feel connected to the problem we've just described.
We just need to get rid of the whole government machinery and the cauldron will bubble over. But going back to what you said your MP said and who the Conservatives want to if you like, make happy in their opinion polls, if that's really their strategy, then I would say that they've lost the next election because all parties, if you don't go telling a story and give people aspiration, whether it's somebody like Alistair of his generation, even if he didn't want to vote Tory, he must still sort of see something attractive about it. So if you don't sell yourself as an attractive proposition for the lower middle class wanting to make good, then I think you've lost it. And in a sense, depending on the Brexit vote, it's a disaster because I think most people have forgotten about it, apart from a few loonies who, whatever you think of Boris, but some of the comments yesterday about him being stranded and snubbed at
Oh, good
NATO.
Lord.
Sorry, I have to bring it in.
Yeah.
And I looked a lot at it. It's just why do they hate Britain? And I can understand disliking Boris, but when he's on the international stage, surely you want to have some respect. I find that
It was so interesting. We should dis
so
describe,
cynical.
but we should describe, because there is a Helen Lewis is taking the writer is taking a break from Twitter, because she says she keeps and she's noticed that things then pop up in newspapers or magazines based on Twitter arguments and Twitter sort of memes. And actually, if you're not on Twitter, you think, well, what on earth is that about? You
Yes.
know, so earlier in the week, it was about Nazanin coming back from Iran, and there were various rows about should she be grateful or not. And that was just because a small smallish, or tens of thousands of people were arguing about it on Twitter. So what happened, just to explain, and I, against my better judgment, ended up tweeting a bit about this last night, was that so Boris Johnson's at the big photo op, which you get at the NATO summits or EU summits, G7, all of that. And we're all familiar with the scene. You have the backdrop and the logo, and the leaders, as they're assembling and coming in from the various meetings, stand around a bit and look a bit embarrassed generally. Now, you've got various approaches as a leader. You can just stand there and pretend to look into the middle distance or wave and spot someone. You can do that. Or you can try and be the show off as though you're organising things, like Macron, of course,
Macron. Who's then.
It's always got to be, look at me, look at me. Mm-hmm. You can do that. Or you can then just sort of bimble about a bit, as Boris did. But broadly, these leaders are on their own for a couple of minutes before the actual picture is taken. And if you zero in for long enough on one leader, they'll look a bit embarrassed or embarrassing for 30 seconds, and you can turn it into a social media clip. So, of course, this was done with Boris. Now, this then went... I came out of various meetings.
He should have a vape on him. He should have vaped it.
Wouldn't it be great if he just lit up a cigarette? I think that would have been the best thing.
Not in vaping. Yeah.
I'm sure some kind of... like proper cigarette. But he... So that's the scene. I came out of a meeting yesterday. You turn on Twitter and there are lots of people, some of them allegedly sophisticated, intelligent people, shouting about this. What a national humiliation it is. Look at him on his own. No one wanted to talk to him. This is a metaphor for Brexit. Then later on in the evening, of course, the full clip emerges and it shows what I suggested, which is just leaders mill about. And there isn't really anything nationally humiliating about it. So this entire fake narrative, which was also, I noticed, picked up a bit by broadcasters.
BBC did.
Yeah,
just
I mean, not
being snubbed. Unbelievable.
Yeah, just it's, and I can see how it happens, but it's an example of what Twitter is doing to our, and social media is doing to our political culture and political communication, in that it is driving certain people around the twist. I would suggest, and there's a great irony because it they're behaving in their response almost in a Trumpian way. Because it is a sophisticated, it's the person who self-defines as the sophisticated anti-populist person who gets most annoyed about this and really hates Boris, then goes on Twitter, gets furious about it and says that it signifies something. But actually, if the critique is supposed to be that truth matters, and if you hate him, then you say that he has contempt for the truth. But what you're then using is a distorted media meme or social media meme to attack him, you're in danger of driving yourself around the twist. Alistair, does that make any sense?
Yeah, of course it does. And it's worse when people are already het up. Well, quite naturally at the moment. Because, you know, and it's happened throughout the kind of diplomatic sort of shenanigans across the West and with Russia, is people make snap judgments very quickly on the basis of a video clip or a quote out of context. There's a serious point here as well, which is that at times the conflict in Ukraine and the way Western policymakers have sometimes responded to it, at times you kind of think, is there a bit too much comms going on here? Would it not be better to leave things with a little creative ambiguity? I mean, for example, does Liz Truss really need to go and give an interview to the Times last weekend where she sort of says the negotiations between Ukraine and Russia are effectively a kind of sham or a smokescreen? Do we need that? Because And the other thing is the MOD doing tweets every day, sort of laying out the picture. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but I think it's good to calmly lay out what's happening, but the fog of war is a real thing, and you risk looking a bit stupid when things
I would, yeah, I distinguish,
don't quite match
yeah.
up with the messaging.
It's a good point. I would distinguish between the two in that actually, I
Yeah.
think that MOD factual, and it's become one of the most interesting and reliable. Of course, it comes from the MOD, and it's of course it's an ally of Ukraine saying this, but it is calmly done, and it's caveated when something can't be confirmed. But it's one of, I think, five or six of the best calm intelligence-based Twitter things on Twitter that's worth checking every day for an update on the war. On the interview thing, I mean, it's really difficult, I suppose, for governments because they want to be seen to be communicating and on top of it. But also, there's a real danger in escalation, isn't there? And you're in a zone where he and the Russians are obviously watching every bit of, as they would see it, Western propaganda. And there's just a danger that a stray comment can then be mischaracterized deliberately by the Russians and have an impact on their strategy. Because that, I mean, that's how escalation very often works, isn't it? It just works by a series of accidents and misunderstandings. And then alliances kick in, as happened in the First World War, and before you know where you are, within a few weeks or months, you've got to a situation, a general European war that at the beginning no one could quite have envisaged. But there is that tension. I know what you mean, Alistair. I mean, but I do think they're actually trying to do less of that, I think, for the reason that I described. I think there's a bit less, they're trying to route most of the communication through Boris Johnson, trying to keep it relatively calm, which didn't work, of course, in the speech where he mentioned Brexit in the context of Ukraine, which was a segue in his speech at Tory Party Spring Conference, but he got a lot of grief for that, and I think it was a mistake. What do you make of it, Maggie?
I think I agree there is a distinction between MOD information and Liz Truss because we have to be aware that at this war between Russia and Ukraine will probably only be solved through some sort of negotiated peace. So if you've got various people like Liz Truss sort of shooting off, suggesting that, it's all a sham, it's not helpful. Everybody knows our stated position. And just, you need an element of secrecy in all negotiations going on. So yeah, I think they need to be
Yeah.
very careful. But I think what we need to, we perhaps should look at Joe Biden's in Poland today with the Polish president and government and other NATO leaders. And the big question now is, what is the next stage? And as we saw yesterday, hints that if Russia were to stray into NATO
Yeah.
territory, then there would be severe repercussions. And Biden made that very plain. And I think the interesting question that we should all be asking is, what does that mean? Is that chemical, if there were a chemical attack or something of that sort on Ukraine, and you had the chemicals drifting across the border into Poland or any other of the six neighboring countries, does that constitute a breaking of Article 5? It's something that hasn't really been addressed yet.
I don't know. I've been reading a lot in the last week or so about escalation, Alistair, and as I said earlier, how it happens and how very often happens by mistake or the role of personalities like MacArthur in the Korean conflict, in the conflict between MacArthur and Truman as president. So there is a real risk. I feel really torn because Russia is the aggressor. We're living in an entirely new era of European security. We need to be as robust as possible. We need to aid the Ukrainians, of course. And we've been among those advocating that for a while. But then equally, you have to try, and the statecraft and diplomacy involved has to be rooted in a calm analysis that avoids unnecessary escalation. And the fear is him testing NATO on the border in some way because of NATO countries are supplying the Ukrainians. How do you see it?
No, I agree, and yeah, I do feel torn. I do think there is a lot of scope. I mean, in terms of what you were describing, Maggie, that Article 5 response. Article 5 itself is also deliberately ambiguous in some ways. It sort of says commits allied partners to do what they think is necessary, I think is the formulation, which it necessary in their own terms. So that can mean
It's
very, you know,
ambiguous.
many, yeah, many things. And that quite rightly, because you need ambiguity. I wonder whether Biden probably slightly overstepped the mark last night, saying it in the terms that he did. And that I was reading in the Times, there does seem to have been a sort of an official blowback from UK officials saying, that was not maybe too, the form of words was too rigid. But I don't know, maybe there was enough ambiguity. I think with all the arguments over settlements and Ukraine, we have to kind of almost go back a little bit to work out what will happen next. I think the reason why Ukraine did not accede to NATO in the early 2000s, along with other countries in Eastern Europe and the Baltic states, the reason why in 2008 they were given almost an invitation to join NATO, a kind of guarantee that there would be a NATO eventually, but no sure date, is because there were deep and continue to be deep divides within the Western alliance about how they view the relationship with Ukraine and the relationship with Russia. I mean, partly the reason why the thing was so watered down in 2008 and emerged in the way it did was because, there was a lot of pressure from European partners who said, we can't get these guys into NATO. We know what will happen in terms of Russia, and we're worried about it, so we're going to fudge it. And that divide is still there. You still see that there is a difference in the way European leaders are talking. For all the united chatter, I don't think there are actually, in terms of Macron and Scholz, they actually have quite different views. If you look carefully at what they're saying in terms of red lines and sanctions and all that, there is not quite the same as Boris and not quite the same as Biden. So there will be those divisions will only widen as the kind of concrete realities unfold about how you eventually have a settlement in Ukraine, which unfortunately, which will ultimately have to respect the Russian paranoia and security fears that have been there since the end of the Cold War and emerged in 19, almost immediately at the end of the Cold War, this fear that, the West would entrap them and wouldn't disarm. It's still there. The status of Eastern Ukraine and the Donetsk and Luhansk and Crimea were problems that pre-existed the war and almost, were problems in the 90s to an extent, especially Crimea, not so much in Eastern Ukraine. But that was because there was sort of a ruling caste in Ukraine, Kuchma, for example, who was from Eastern Ukraine, who was viewed very in a by this kind of post-industrial heartlands of Ukraine, these industrial heartlands, as standing up for Ukraine. He wasn't necessarily unfriendly to Russia. So there's a sort of a series of complexities around the status of Ukraine that will still be there when the war has died down. And I think we need to be psychologically prepared for potentially a long and uncertain digging in on both sides and a long series of negotiations and all the consequences of that for Western politics. And there won't be a quick settlement and there won't be a final defeat, I think, for either Ukraine or Russia. And that has, anyway.
So there's a
I think, does that make
possibility of a
sense?
long conflict, and I think it's a really good point about NATO. But of course, what was going on simultaneously, it can't be divorced from the spectacular miscalculation made, principally but not exclusively, by the German political establishment and by Merkel, because running in parallel with all of that NATO stuff, it was a period when, not citing Donald Trump as having any particular wisdom on this, but his analysis on NATO that it was essentially about Europe not being prepared to take its defense seriously or pay for it properly was broadly correct. But every decision that NATO made was in the context of Merkel saying, well, look, it's fine because this guy's containable and the German economic model is to suck in cheap energy from Russia and then spew out huge amounts of exports to China, subsidized by that cheap energy. So the German economic model in that period was meant that Western European policymakers, the key Western policymakers, were preconditioned to not be robust on the NATO front, and that put Ukraine and successive Ukrainian governments in an almost impossible position because the NATO leaders wanted to go and make positive speeches and lots of warm words about solidarity and future expectations. But really, when it came to it, the European policy was characterized by being too nice to Putin and thinking that he could be controlled. So I think
The sad thing is just to come also back on that on energy, is the Ukrainians suffered in some ways from the same illusion. You
yes.
know, the Ukrainian economy has been totally dependent on
Yep.
subsidized Russian gas ever since the end of the Cold War, and it was a huge bone of contention. The Russians constantly saying, why are you being, you know, why are you signaling after the Orange Revolution that you're being unfriendly to us when we effectively subsidize, you know, that we keep give you economic stability. Because you know we marked down the amount of gas, and then you had the sort of gas wars in the 2010s and onwards, and it's kind of one of these things where it's like, I think what we need to be psychologically prepared for is if there is a, I mean, what will come out of this is a Ukrainian state which is still a relatively weak state, but one that has you know a new sense of national solidarity. But potentially has problems securing its territory. There'd be
I'm
militia, there's a
not,
huge amount of
yeah.
arms that have gone in. We need to be prepared to pay for Ukraine much more than we have in the past, not just the odd 100 million here or there. This is,
It's
you
going to
know,
be
this is real
expensive.
East Timor territory. This is
Yeah.
rebuilding the whole thing
It's the
and making it
Marshall
into
Plan.
the strong state it needs to be. And
It's go it's
that's
going
going to
to
be a big
it's
thing
going
to
to be
sell.
expensive, but actually I slightly disagree, Alistair. I think it will be, if anything, a much stronger state. You look at what's happening to, and of course opinion polling in a war zone is difficult, but you can also poll emigres and you get a sense of Ukrainian public opinion, and it's phenomenal what's happened. Just the level of national feeling and national unity, something has been created here which lasts generations as a political idea or inspiration. And he's achieved precisely the opposite of what he set out to do. So I think you potentially see a stronger sense of national feeling, a stronger state, obviously a national leader who's there as long as he can survive, who's an inspirational figure, probably huge amounts of European Union aid, vigilance on in terms of the penetration of Ukrainian society. So the thing which existed beforehand, which was essentially that Russia could flood the place with FSB and disrupt Ukrainian society and just sort of play politics and create confusion, that then doesn't apply afterwards. So you have probably a much stronger security state funded in part by the West, and then huge amounts of weapons, because the Ukrainians will rightly have drawn the conclusion they have to be armed to the teeth forever, because you don't know who the next Russian leader or the one after that will be. Listen, I think we're probably going to wrap things up there on the Reaction podcast there this week, and thank Alistair and Maggie for joining me. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you want to get my weekly newsletter, Maggie's weekly column, all of the work from the team, there's loads of coverage on the war, geopolitics, and all sorts of other things as well. The details are below. You become a Reaction annual subscriber. And until next time, thank you very much for listening.